Okay. Anybody have any questions about what we've talked about so far? Okay, the last little comment on this section. Oh, yes.
I did have one question. Good. It came up earlier, and it kind of, you went into it later as well. But talking about these different expressions of enlightenment, or the way people act out their lives afterwards differently. And what I'm used to is not the hermit, but you hear more about the bodhisattva, who is driven purely by this sense of unlimited compassion. And trying to bring all other sentient beings to the same point they've reached.
Yes.
And almost like that's the only thing that motivates them. So I'm wondering with these, like the crusty guys in the caves, what's what actually gets them moving? Because you'd assume that there'd be nothing left to motivate.
Mm-hmm.
So what would keep them going? Are they trying to attain deeper insights for themselves?
The question is, what keeps the crusty guys crusty?
what keeps the crusty guys going?
What keeps the crusty guys going? That is a very good question. Actually, that's a question that a couple of other people asked me about on the break. Let me tell you a little interesting thing about that. I'll jump ahead and I'll read you a little quote on page, let's see. On page 4, second paragraph about some popular notions about enlightenment. And so we will be talking more about this. But all such expectations are doomed. As William Hamilton said, I haven't met an arhat who wasn't a unique caricature of the personality he was before enlightenment. And as Sayada Upandita once said, because of habit patterns, it's possible for an arahant to be obnoxious. However, the difference with arahants is that if it is pointed out to them that they are obnoxious, they are capable of reflecting on situations and changing their behavior. Now, that's arahants. That's the highest level of enlightenment. There was an interesting study done by Engler and Brown back in the 70s. That they had people at several different stages of enlightenment, as judged by their teachers and their peers, and they did a variety of personality evaluations on them. They were looking to see if there were any particular patterns that were associated with. They weren't only looking at stages of insight. There are at stages of enlightenment. They were also looking at stages of insight preceding enlightenment. So it was a pretty good study. But what they found is that in sort of the middle stages of enlightenment, that the personality characteristics were quite exaggerated. So whatever personality characteristics a person had before would tend to become exaggerated. What they found that was really interesting with arhats. Now, this quote I just read you from William Hamilton says arhats are a caricature of the personality that they had before. But they also... They're not really the crusty, obnoxious ones, because they may have some as a caricature of the personality they were before. They may come across as being, you know, gruff and or these kinds of characteristics. But underlying that, their greatest desire is to teach and to help other people. And this is what Engler and Brown found, is that In the Asian Arhat that they were interviewing, they gave him a series of Rorschach inkblots, which was a part of their investigation they did, and he turned the whole series of inkblots into a teaching. And they said it was incredible. They never imagined that anybody could do that. But he turned a series of inkblots, and the interpretation of it was just this wonderful teaching. You know, and they found something similar with a shaman that was hugely admired and taken to be a very, very holy man. That when they interviewed him and they did these tests, everything they did, he would turn it into a teaching and a guidance for them. And so I think this is a difference that you get with it. In the intermediate stages of enlightenment, the person still has, you know, they still have some degree of attachment, some degree of sense of self, some degree of desire and aversion, depending on the stage that you're at, which is what we're going to be talking about next. But, and their personality characteristics tend to come out even more strongly. So, you know, somebody who was an aloof, impatient, maybe a little bit misanthropic to begin with, you know, they may make a lot of wonderful changes in themselves and achieve the first or the second stage of enlightenment, but they still have these characteristics, and they may become very exaggerated. And so they may be the ones that, you know, sit in a cave and they don't want anybody to come around. I don't know. I'd have to go to a tour of the Himalayas and check in on the caves to validate this. But that's my guess, I've been having a wonderful time on and off this last couple of years studying enlightenment and all of the things that are written about enlightened beings. And this picture is emerging, you know, that fits with this, that in the middle stages, that this is where you might get some of this. Like one of Jack Kornfield's teachers, there was an article that Jack Kornfield wrote for, I can't remember the name of it now, that happens to me sometimes. Does anybody know that newspaper format journal that they, what's that?
Spirit Rock.
Tricycle is a glossy magazine. This looks like a newspaper. It comes out quarterly or twice a year.
Oh, hey, the Insight.
Meditation, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. But anyway, he wrote an article in there once talking about his different teachers, and he talked about this one teacher who, you know, shouted at people and smoked cigars and kicked the cat and all that sort of stuff. You know, well, this doesn't sound like your idea of an enlightened person. But nobody said he was an arhat. But he was a teacher in the Mahasi tradition. And in that tradition, you're not allowed to become, or you're not formally recognized as a teacher until you've attained the second level of enlightenment. So I think I take him to be an example of that. You know, he was at maybe the second level of enlightenment, qualified as a teacher, but definitely not an arhat. So some of these personality characteristics that he had would still manifest. But that's about as good an answer as I can give you to that one.
So I guess I think this is what you're saying, but basically the way you've described it is once you really attain like the level of an arhat, it's just this natural consequence of that is this completely non-dual, completely limitless compassion.
That's right.
All that remains.
So any
of these guys that are choosing to go into seclusion are not likely fully realized.
That's right. They're still working on becoming realized. Once they become realized, then, of course, their ability, well, they're realized, they're not fully realized. But no matter what stage that somebody is at in enlightenment, including as an arhat, their ability to teach is going to be still dependent upon, you know, their their innate abilities, their personality characteristics, their own training and things like that. I could see that some arhats might feel that they are not capable of teaching or not know how to teach, but I can't imagine an arhat whose primary motivation wouldn't be to help other beings in whatever way they could, even if they didn't feel like they were competent to teach, even if they couldn't turn a series of Rorschachs into teaching, they would still want to help guide others. You know, the fact that somebody wants to stay in a cave by themselves means that they're still working. You know, they've still got work to do. Not there yet. Yes, that's the way that I felt when I came to Arizona. Is that I wasn't interested in teaching or having anybody else around or anything else. I just wanted to hide out in my mountains and do my own thing. I had work to do. So, but okay. Well, any other questions? Then we're almost finished this first section and getting into the specifically Buddhist view of enlightenment. One last little point here that I do, and I mentioned to you earlier the distinction between the enlightenment experience and state of being enlightened. And this is once again from Ullman and Reichenberg Ullman's book. They say, we recognize that it is possible for a person to undergo a transient experience of illumination without remaining in a permanent state of oneness. And that could mean several different things. Of course, somebody on the first stage of enlightenment is permanently transformed, but they're not in a permanent state of oneness, because that doesn't come until later on. They're not an arhat. The other thing it could mean is that there are these amazing, incredible, mystical experiences that people can have, but they are not, they don't do the trick. They don't make the change. That the definition of enlightenment from the Buddhist perspective, the original definition of enlightenment, is all based on the permanent changes that take place. And what you'll find in the Buddhist tradition is a teacher may say of a student's experience that may have been an enlightenment experience, we'll see over the next few years.
Okay.
So, we'll see whether it did the trick. So. Okay, now let's look at the specifically Buddhist view of enlightenment. In the sutras, we find the Buddha speaking very clearly that what he teaches is suffering and the end of suffering. And he very consistently throughout always brought everything back to this same defining characteristic, the end of suffering, in terms of the purpose of the teaching, why you came to the teaching, what it was meant to accomplish, and so forth. But, of course, in the teaching, it's made very clear that the cause of suffering is craving in the form of desire and aversion. And it's also made very, very clear that the only way suffering can be completely overcome is if craving is completely and permanently extinguished. And it's also made very, very clear that craving cannot be permanently extinguished until ignorance has been destroyed. And what's meant by ignorance here specifically is ignorance as to the true nature of reality, the true nature of self. Or we might say ignorance refers to the delusion that we have of being a separate self-existent self in a world of self-existent objects. And so, although the Buddha always defined the goal of the path in terms of the end of suffering. It takes only the most cursory examination of the teaching to realize you can't have suffering without the end of craving, and you can't have the end of craving without the destruction of ignorance. So all of that follows automatically from it. So therefore, on the basis of the original teachings of the Buddha in the sutras, we can expect an enlightened person to be, number one, free from suffering, of course. Number two, free from the compulsions of desire and aversion that cause suffering. Three, free from ignorance and attachment to phenomena as relatively enduring and independently existent. And to understand that attachment to phenomena inevitably leads to dissatisfaction and suffering. And four, to be free from ignorance and attachment to the personal self as an independent, self-existent entity, whether permanently abiding or subject to annihilation, and to understand that attachment to self inevitably leads to dissatisfaction and suffering. So this is kind of a logical conclusion, a simple, concise statement of the definition of what it means to be enlightened from the information that's provided in the sutras. In that last one, they have reference to self, the self as an independent, self-existent entity, whether permanently abiding or subject to annihilation. These were the two views that were predominant at the time of the Buddha. One was that this self or soul or Atman was permanent, and that it would be reincarnated in a new body, like taking off a suit of clothes and putting on a new suit of clothes, over and over again. And, of course, within the Brahmanic, with the Vedantic development of the Brahmanic culture, the goal was to achieve the escape from the cycle of continual reincarnation by the Atman achieving union with Brahman, which I talked about before. Within the Vedantic system, that is the enlightenment. But in terms of views of the self, the Buddha did not accept the Atman view of a permanent abiding self. And the other predominant view that competed with that at the time was the materialist, who also believed that you had a self, but that it was annihilated at death. Although there were some that believed that it might go on for a few hundred thousand lifetimes, but it was subject to annihilation and destruction. So the Buddha refuted those and said that you know, those of you who say the self is eternal, you're wrong. Those of you who say the self is annihilated, you're wrong. Because there isn't any self. So that's the Buddha's definition of enlightenment. Free from suffering, free from compulsions of desire or aversion, free from ignorance and attachment to phenomena as being self-existently, as independently self-existent, and free from ignorance and attachment to the personal self as being an independent, self-existent entity. Is that clear? Yeah. How does that fit in with everything else we've talked about tonight?
Perfectly.
It actually does. It's the Buddhist take on it, but it is completely consistent with the descriptions of enlightenment that come from other traditions as well. Yeah. So absolutely. So we're not really talking about something very different. But one of the things that is very different, and I don't know of any other tradition that does this, is the Buddhist tradition recognizes that enlightenment is not an all or nothing thing. It happens by stages. Now, within Buddhism, there are some schools that subscribe to sudden enlightenment. And they're a little bit difficult to untangle when you look at them. for some of them, their sudden enlightenment doesn't turn out to be much different than this enlightenment by stages, which is called the gradual enlightenment. But I think one of the tremendous values in Buddhism is that everything is systematized, it is broken down, and it's analyzed, and there's clear-cut procedures and steps and paths to follow, and so forth. And that's true of all of the training that takes place in meditation as part of the path to enlightenment. But it's true of enlightenment itself. The four stages, they're given at the bottom of this page here. The first stage of enlightenment is called the stream enterer. You know, the arhat is the stream, is the person who's crossed to the other side. But the first stage is the stream enterer. Another meaning of stream enterer is that once you've entered the stream, you're carried by the power of the stream after that. And so once the person has entered the stream, their complete enlightenment, their attainment of the fourth stage is guaranteed. Mm-hmm. There's no falling back. The stream enterer is also known as the seven times returner. And the stages that follow that, the next stage is called the once returner. The third stage is called the non-returner. And then the fourth stage is called the arhat. And what this returner business is all about, well, the traditional... remember, the Buddha was teaching at a time when everybody took it for granted that you're dying, you're reincarnated. This was the Brahmanical tradition going back thousands of years, and so what the seven times returner means is that somebody who has become a stream entrant would be reborn at most seven times before they become an arhat. And so the once returner, if you've achieved that stage, then you would be reborn at most once. The third stage is called the non-returner. And if you don't become an arhat in that lifetime, then the non-returner is not reborn in the sense realm, in the human realm. But rather they are reborn in a special, much higher realm, a deva realm. And they achieve complete enlightenment in that realm. And then an arhat is somebody who has achieved full and complete enlightenment. Now there's another way of interpreting this, which is more consistent with the Buddha's teaching of no self, which is that, and it also is consistent with what is involved in these paths and what we find there. A person who is a stream entrant is still capable of being caught up in the world of appearances. Not for very long, and won't become too deeply immersed in it, because it's achieved a level of knowledge that once his loss of perspective causes a certain amount of suffering to develop, or once the loss of perspective has caused him to behave in such a way that he started to cause visible harm to others around him, he will reawaken to the truth that he knows and will make amends. So the idea is that for somebody who's a stream entrant, this could happen a number of times. Not a tremendous number of times, not dozens of times or hundreds of times, but a few times, like up to seven, say. With the second path, this person has made some great progress. They are, let me go back to the first one and give you an analogy here, because I'm going to use it in describing the second path. In the first, in the stream infant, the first path attainment, this could be likened to a person who's having a bad dream, and they wake up, and it was just a dream. But they don't get out of bed, they don't stay awake, they doze off again, and the bad dream might start up again. This might happen a few times before they completely wake up and they get out of bed and they're done with it once and for all. Okay, the second path, the second stage, the once returner. This is a person who has they are still subject to desire and aversion, but greatly weakened, greatly attenuated, not nearly as much so as before. And so what they do is they go back into the world of suffering deliberately for the purpose of completely and permanently uprooting all of the last traces of craving or from materiality that they have. So they've returned once more, but they've returned more or less deliberately. Or this might be likened to somebody who's in the middle of a bad dream, wakes up, realizes that was just a dream, and then is able, as a lucid dreamer, to go back into the dream and change the way that they respond to the situation. And then the third stage is the non-returner. The non-returner has overcome all craving, all desire and aversion, has no need to, actually no possibility of being caught up in the world of suffering in the sense realm ever again. The work that they have to do is of a different sort. And then the arhat is the completely awakened one. So that's the Buddhist, specifically Buddhist version of enlightenment, very, very similar to the general one, description that we find across different cultures, but far more systematic, and especially the emphasis on stages, different stages of enlightenment, and that it doesn't happen all at once. Also, as we'll look at in more detail as we go into this, there's the very systematic training and preparation. So, anybody have any questions about that? There is in some people may have heard or may wonder, well, are all arhats like the Buddha was? And it depends on what ways that you're talking about. In terms of their enlightenment, an arhat is a Buddha. It's fully enlightened. But there was obviously something different about the person that we call the Buddha. After all, I don't know how many arhats there are in the world right now, but there are arhats in the world. And they don't seem to be having quite the same impact that Siddhartha Gautama did after his enlightenment. Agree? So he is said to be a Sammasambuddha. A Sammasambuddha. And here, this is part of what you might call the religious aspect of Buddhism. It is the tradition, the traditional teachings. But it is said that every time that in this vast history of sentient beings that is without beginning and without end, that the teachings of the Dharma always get lost. There comes a time when they degenerate and are lost and forgotten. And that every time this happens, that a new Sammasambuddha appears. who will come and turn the wheel of Dharma once again and reestablish these teachings in the world. And so Siddhartha Gautama was the Sammasambuddha of our time. And it is said that the way that somebody becomes a Sammasambuddha is that in a far, far distant life in the past, that person would have made a commitment to the Sammasambuddha, to a Sammasambuddha at that time, to themselves become a Sammasambuddha for the future. So we have this picture that I can't remember the term. You know, they have countless eons of you know, incredible numbers of years. They go back, you know, beyond fathoming, and all of these lifetimes. And somewhere in that process, the person who became our Buddha made the commitment to another Buddha in another time, and then spent all of these lifetimes in between perfecting himself, perfecting his merit, so that when he was born in that final lifetime and became himself enlightened, he would have the power to reestablish the Dharma in the world and to teach huge numbers of people. And so that's the explanation for the difference between the Buddha and other Arhats, is that he has all these uncountable lifetimes dedicated to perfecting himself, practicing the perfections and perfecting himself.
Incarnate?
In incarnations, yes. Right.
I'm just going to say, but if there's no self, then... Yeah. Mm-hmm. Then nothing.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah. That's why I said it belongs to the religious side of Buddhism. Yeah. Yes?
You said at another time that Buddha never talked about incarnation, but rebirth, and that incarnation, how we understand it, is not how he sees it, but here is the word again. So I'm a little confused with that. What do you mean by it?
Okay, what he did is he redefined reincarnation, and because the notion of reincarnation is based on the idea that the self we think we are is substantial and permanent. And he said he speaks of rebirth and what is reborn. What is reborn is the karma that a person has accumulated, okay? And so there are different levels of teaching in the scholastic analysis of Asian Buddhism. There's a distinction between two levels of Buddhism. They actually overlap. They're not really distinct. One is referred to as village Buddhism or lay Buddhism, or as religious Buddhism. Okay, and the other is referred to as virtuoso Buddhism. And virtuoso Buddhism really has two divisions within it. I mean, this is a scholastic analysis of Buddhism as an entity in the world. Virtuoso Buddhism is seen as having two divisions: a scholastic division, which are all those that carefully analyze and scrutinize the doctrine and make everything add up and everything like that, make sense of it, and then the contemplative division of virtuoso Buddhism, who says, "I don't need your analysis. I'm going to sit down, fold my legs and my hands, close my eyes, and find out for myself." Okay. And there are numerous what appear to be contradictions between village Buddhism and virtuoso Buddhism, or lay Buddhism and virtuoso Buddhism. But scholastic Buddhism has very neatly sewed them all together so that they flow. So with there is one level of Buddhism where you speak of reincarnation. But then on the more sophisticated level, this is explained in terms of the doctrines of emptiness and no self, so that there is no contradiction. Okay? You can't explain to large numbers of people who are not going to put the time and the effort and perhaps lack the educational background and the intellectual ability, these very, very subtle interpretations. And so what you find is that amongst religious Buddhists, it follows a pattern of most religions. As I was talking earlier, talking about Christian, you know, an ordinary Christian compared to a Christian mystic. An ordinary Buddhist believes that he or she, as they perceive themselves, is going to return to this world. And they believe that by keeping precepts and doing various meritorious acts, that they are going to ensure for themselves a rebirth under good circumstances, under beneficial circumstances. And of course, the within that belief system, they could be reborn as a lizard or a frog or in a hell realm or as a hungry ghost or anything else. So you see, once again, there is the polarity between the individual and some power beyond them. And then there's a set of rules and behaviors and things like by which they can manipulate their own future destiny. And so religious Buddhism is based on the technically erroneous assumption that there is a self that is reincarnated, and that self is the carrier of karma and is the beneficiary of merit and so forth. Mm-hmm. But at the level of virtuoso Buddhism, this is all reinterpreted, that the only thing that continues is the karmic propensities that have been developed. And then the further analysis of that becomes very sophisticated. But on the religious side of Buddhism, of course, things have to be explained about how come our arahants aren't like the Buddha was. So, yes?
I find all of that very problematic in Buddhism as well as other religions on the religious side, because, you know, if the virtuoso side of Buddhism tolerates this other kind of religious Buddhism, it's tolerating a lie, isn't it?
Well, it's not seen that way. It's seen as different, as having a powerfully beneficial effect on large numbers of people who otherwise would have nothing to counteract their unwholesome predispositions. You know, it brings a morality, it brings an order. Not only that, it creates the opportunity for some of them to decide to go into it more deeply, or to take robes and go into the monasteries. So it's not seen at all as spreading a lie. It's rather seen as presenting truth in a form that can be understood by people of a lesser capacity. Okay. So if And that's a valid point of view. If there are those people who can't understand this other view, and that's what I mean by lesser capacity, then they're better off believing that if they keep precepts, and if they practice generosity, and if they, you know, avoid harming others and all of these other things, that they will be reborn in better circumstances, and at the same time can say to themselves, well, in a sense, since there is no self anyway, and since every action mental or physical, has consequences. And since those consequences will be realized in the future, that in that sense, there will be a future being who reaps the benefits of those actions. So, in that sense, strictly speaking, it's not a lie. It's not false. It's just offering the truth to somebody in a form that they can understand more easily.
So they may reach enlightenment in spite of their beliefs.
Well, as a matter of fact, they can, yes. Mm-hmm. The beliefs are not... As a matter of fact, the only thing that's important in terms of enlightenment is that you are able to step outside of your beliefs long enough to become enlightened. And then after you're enlightened, you can go back to trying to interpret everything in terms of those beliefs again. And that's not a problem. You know, if you're Teresa of Avila or John of the Cross, you interpret it in terms of Christianity. Mm-hmm. You know, and if you're a Zen Roshi, you interpret it in terms of the belief system that you brought with you. And really, you know, we say, you've got to remember, it's all empty. Our mind.
It is, really. I love that.
It is. It really is empty. You know? And that's not... And that's not an empty statement either. What do we mean by empty? We mean that these brains that we have, these minds we have, can only work by constructing things in a particular way. And there's nothing inherently more correct about one construction than another. I mean, there can be a greater or lesser degree of validity in some sense, but there can be equally valid constructions that seem to be totally different from each other. You know, it really and truly is all empty underneath it all. Yeah.
Once you achieve enlightenment,
yes?
Once you have achieved enlightenment, what need would you have to go back to the particular religious construction of reality?
To teach.
Well, it is the framework that you have in order to communicate with others. And what need would you have to find a different framework as long as you could do that? Mm-hmm. You know, and if you become fully enlightened and your greatest wish is to help others to achieve what you have, mm-hmm. then there's no reason to throw out the set of tools that you used. Rather, you will naturally want to use those and to show others how to use them in the same way. Mm-hmm. I mean, what you could do, now, in that regard, what you could do is say, well, this system, this philosophy, this theology, whatever it is that I learned, you know, I can leave out the parts that are most useless, and I can maybe modify the ones that are more problematic. And we've seen this. We see this in the history of all religions, and we especially see it in Buddhism, because Buddhism, by and large, has been less rigidly bound, you know, as it has taken on more and more of the accretions of religious form. It has been, you know, it has still been a predominantly mystical tradition. And so you constantly have people becoming enlightened. And they become enlightened and they say, well, you know, I have a whole lot better way to teach this, right? And as a result, you've had a lot of new sutras come up too. They say, here, I've got a better way of teaching this, and you have a new sutra that presents that better way of teaching it. So.
And there's no Pope.
What's that?
And there's no Pope.
That's right, there's no Pope. I think that helps a lot.
Is it a little bit like Zen saying, enlightenment, you carry water and chop wood, and after enlightenment, you carry.
Well, certainly, yes. As far as having the same, system that you started with, it's true. You know, before enlightenment, chop wood and carry water. I mean, that's referring to something else, but also true that, you know, if this is the system that you spent the last 20 years or whoever knows training in, you're not going to throw it out and go shopping for a new one all over again. Mm-hmm. You're going to make use of it to continue your own path, and then when it's reached its fulfillment, to teach and to guide others and to help mm-hmm. others. So in that regard, it is the same way. But what you'll see over and over again in Buddhism is it keeps being improved upon, changed, modified, you know, added to, refined. And these refinements are being done by people who have achieved the final path. And they've looked, you know, see, what is taught today, in the process of being taught, acquires this kind of conceptual baggage and distortion and cultural accretions, Buddhism taught in Sri Lanka to Sri Lankans is presented in a particular way that they're going to understand best and clearest. And that's not the same way that Buddhism, that the same ideas are conveyed in Tibet, because it's a different culture. So in Tibet, it's taught in a different form, which Tibetans can understand and catch on to a lot more quickly than Sri Lankans could. And likewise in Thailand or China or Japan. You know, each culture has its own, provides its own context. And so the teaching has to change to be effective in the context. Over time, the teaching becomes distorted as a result of the context. Somebody else comes along and straightens it out again. Then it gets taken out of that cultural context into a completely new cultural context. And the teachings, two things happen. They don't work as well, so they get changed once again. But also, because they brought some stuff from this other culture, it got further distorted because it didn't make the same kind of sense. And so, you know, on the one hand, you look at Buddhism and you say, what a mess. It is so confusing and contradictory. And, you know,
it's alive. It's a
messy. That's
alive.
True. It is alive and it's organic. You know, if it were just a set of teachings that, you know, the Buddha said this and nobody's allowed to change a word of it and everything else. And there are traditions that try to make that happen too. That's another way it gets distorted.
They call it the Bible.
You know. But as long as it's alive, as long as there are new Buddhas coming into the world, new arhats, new enlightened people teaching others, it's going to keep changing and taking new forms. And, you know, and it uses whatever it has. But I can't imagine how over the last 25 years, 2,500 years, that Buddhism could have remained established without offering people the idea of reincarnation and the ideas of accumulation of merit and superior rebirths and things like that. You know, it's, and I think, you know, the Buddha recognized that. He used that language, he used that as a means of teaching in his time, and that's happened ever since. I'm wondering what's going to happen in the future, though, because in Western society, we don't have a tradition of believing in reincarnation. In Western society, there is a very strong component who is more like the materialists, and they view the idea of the self, but they're kind of suspecting that self disappears at when the body breaks up. We also, Western society, as I mentioned to you, science and psychology and philosophy have all discovered the truth of no self. And it's starting to be more and more understood. So I suspect that we're coming up on a Buddhism of the future, which is going to teach a much more refined version of these things, a much more sophisticated version of these things, a little bit closer to the virtuoso Buddhism that has heretofore been confined to the people in the monasteries who have devoted their lives to either scholastic study or meditation. And I'm very eager to see how that turns out. But I think that's, I think it has to happen. That's part of what I'm hopefully talking with you about this weekend, is that what human beings need to do is to adopt a completely new value system that's based on this kind of wisdom and understanding that comes from these mystical traditions. We've got to grow out of and leave behind the mythical, magical past that we dwelt in, because large numbers of people have to achieve a transcendent understanding. It would be wonderful if everybody did, but enough of our society has to achieve a transcendent understanding that society's values as a whole change. Otherwise, we're going to, you know, talk about all these species going extinct. We're going to be one of them, and we're going to put ourselves away.
Well, in a way, isn't the very fact that our culture is in such a dissolute,
in such a rich,
in such a dissolute and strange period, working for this transformation?
Yes.
Because it's becoming more and more painful and more and more impossible to sustain the delusion.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. But the interesting thing about Buddhism is that it works so well with Western notions of science, and so I think the potential is enormous and wonderful. So we've pretty much used up the time tonight. I wanted to do some meditation with you, and